Welcome to Business Frontiers in Malta, the program exploring the dynamic world of enterprise, innovation, and economic transformation. This series shines a light on startups and entrepreneurship, powerful forces reshaping how we live, work, and do business in Malta and beyond. From bold ideas to disruptive technologies, entrepreneurs are challenging the status quo and driving global change. We will explore what fuels their journey, how they scale, and the obstacles they face in today's competitive markets. Whether you are a founder, policymaker, investor, or just curious about the frontier of modern business, this series is for you. I am your host, Professor Anne-Marie Take, from the Department of Policy, Politics and Governance, and we are broadcasting from the university's radio station, Campus 103.7. On today's program, we'll be talking with our special guest, Natalia Malia, diving into the topic, Shaping the Future of Education, the Axon Park Story. So stay tuned because you won't want to miss a moment. Natalia Malia is the lead AI engineer passionate about building intelligent, impactful systems. Starting as a data scientist, Natalia worked across semiconductors, edge AI, logistics, and education, evolving from data analysis to leading AI design and deployment. She specialized in transforming complex problems into practical, scalable solutions through process optimization, automation, and innovation. Her focus is on creating AI that is useful, ethical, and seamlessly integrated into real-world applications. Driven by curiosity and collaboration, she stays at the forefront of emerging trends to push the boundaries of what AI can achieve and how it can meaningfully shape the future. Natalia, welcome.
Hi, everyone. It's nice to meet you.
Can you tell us about your role as an AI lead engineer at Axon Park?
Of course. So in my day-to-day as the lead AI engineer, my role is to oversee all operations that have to do with AI. So you would ask yourself, okay, well, what do you do with AI? Don't you just use ChatGPT? Having been into this industry for about 7 years, I would say, yes, yeah, not just ChatGPT, unfortunately, and AI has been existing since the 1950s. So you can imagine there's quite a bit of depth to it. Going away from just the technical details of, you know, creating your AI system, of putting it together, making sure that it runs, making sure that it's accurate, making sure that it's following all of your business KPIs, you've also got the idea of, okay, well, you've got AI. Is it ethical? Is it transparent? Is it fair? Do we know what it's doing? Or is it just this black box where you've got input, you've got output, but what's happening in the middle? You know, where's this middle layer? And I try to facilitate that both on the business side where I'm creating the values for the stakeholders to show them, you know, this is what the AI is doing, this is how accurate it is, and this is how it's structured. And at the same time, I'm also developing the algorithms to make sure that it is making sense with our platform, that all of the different components, bits and pieces and gears are coming together nicely with it, because AI is so random sometimes that you've got to contain it between very tight guardrails to get what you want out of it. And then there's the aspect of integrating it with important frameworks in business like GDPR. Now we've got the EU AI Act as well that's starting to control just how far AI systems can go, which systems are high risk, which aren't. So anyway, a lot of this chatter to say that basically any and all things AI are under my jurisdiction, and I try to lead my teams to interface between both business and development and reach a very happy middle path that keeps us compliant but also innovative.
Okay, Natalia, you said a lot of things, and I think for the sake of our listeners, I think we need to unpack a little bit about what you've spoken about. Okay, let's start with, you know, we're talking about AI, artificial intelligence. Can you give us an example of what you mean when you say that you want to make sure that you are ethical or that you ensure that everything is compliant? In concrete terms?
The one thing that people tend to miss about AI is the fact that AI has a lot of caveats, right? So AI is never perfect. AI is really just the culmination of all of the data that we've gathered from humanity, right? And humanity has problems. We are biased. So, for example, when you think about the word doctor, what's the first thing that comes into your mind? is going to be a white male individual 99% of the time. But that's just not the truth, is it, in our day-to-day? Doctors are female. They come from different religions, different races, different backgrounds. But because they are so poorly represented in our society and as a byproduct in our data, we end up in a situation where the AI tends to not only capture these biases, but they become amplified. So let's say we have the scenario where you're hiring people, for example. People are now going for AI hiring. Studies have shown that people that do not have white names or female names are less prioritized in hiring. What's that going to say about our workforce then in 2-3 days when everything is automated?
Very interesting. So you're saying that, let's take a concrete example to add on to what you're saying. A company employs or wishes to look for someone to fill in a vacancy. Sometimes it's a hard-filled vacancy. Would AI facilitate that process?
It does in the sense that it is able to run through hundreds of thousands of CVs in a matter of minutes. So it facilitates the process, but is it really going to highlight your top candidates to you? And that's where the ethical AI component comes in. Are your top candidates truly the cream of the crop because of their skills? Or have they been seen through a biased lens where because you have a name from a different origin, they've suddenly been tossed to the side because, no, we don't see these people in these kinds of positions.
So how does AI help this now to improve such a situation?
AI is the one that's most affected by this.
Okay. And does the HR manager in this case, who generally takes care of recruitment, does he or she identify the certain characteristics required for that particular post?
I would say that yes, they still have to do their secondary check and make sure that whatever the AI has brought to them is really high quality. But there are gaps in that, you know, when you've got hundreds and thousands of resumes, you're not going to be able to manually go through every single one. So you're not even able to spot that there's been some bias happening when you're getting your top five candidates.
Right. Okay. So just to understand now yourself, you know, what first inspired you to work in AI and immersive learning technology?
Well, this has been a long journey coming. Well, my tinkering habits started from when I was very, very young. We found some old footage back in my parents' place that had me at 7 years old building up this little stickle brick car. I don't know if we remember the toys. They're like Legos, but a bit more mishmash type of thing. Yes. And little old me had just put a little car together. I looked at my parents right in the eye and went, look, this is the self-driving car. It will take you from here to Valletta in 2 minutes. Only 1 million euro.
Okay. And based on that, that is why you are today a lead engineer in AI.
It kickstarted it. Now, AI came a little bit later because growing up, we never heard about what AI was. And I spent a majority of my life having my family tell me, but what are you doing? Because I went to study AI both in both as my bachelor's degree and my master's degree. And the family is always going, but what is this AI? And I've grown used to telling them, oh, it's robots. It's robots. And they've gotten quite comfortable with that answer until ChatGPT dropped. Then everybody magically knows what AI is, but never mind the fact that I spent 6 years trying to explain it.
So you knew this. Was this through your reading, through an exposure, through somebody saying something? How did you develop this love for this area?
It started a little bit from pop culture, I would say, because everyone was always imagining the little sci-fi automatic robots. And I always had this dream from when I was young that I would have some robot that does everything for me. The cooking, the cleaning, I think we've all dreamed of having this kind of thing in our house, right?
Yes, okay. And you mentioned that, you know, in your bachelor's and your master's, did you study at the University of Malta?
Yes, I did. In fact, I found one of my main passions from AI came through the fact that I was choosing what to study coming into university. And it was brand new at the time, maybe 3 years old as a course.
On AI, you mean?
On AI, yes.
Okay. All right. And this is with the faculty of ICT?
Yes. Okay.
So if I had to ask you, what is a typical day like for an AI engineer in a virtual learning environment?
Well, we start off by, as every corporate person does, checking our emails because there's usually quite a bit coming in, questions coming in from all different types of directions because there's a lot of, let's say, a lack of clarity, let's say, about the subject. So there's always a lot of back and forth and people just trying to figure things out. Even from the perspective of the EU AI Act now, you've got hundreds of people just coming in, asking, what are we doing? There's these new stuff coming up, like AI literacy is a new term popping up. Like, what is this AI literacy? Which is just being aware of the caveats of AI. So part of that is being very hands-on in answering these questions, you know, kind of being there at the forefront, staying steady and staying up to date. So anyone, whether it's your boss or whether it's your colleague, if they have a question, you're just able to answer that. There's a lot of programming involved, of course. You know, 3/4 of my day is spent going tick, 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 tick on my screen, just trying to make sure things work. And then I have a lot of meetings to catch up on, of course, and it's a lot of coordinating with the team. So I have to make sure that all of my team members are fully aligned, they're able to understand the vision, and that they can kind of, you know, they have the clarity needed to get on with their tasks, because they're doing quite a bit of the programming as well. You know, I have to be in a bit more of a managerial position. So maybe I'm not as hands-on technical as I used to be now that I've evolved in my role, but I'm definitely more in the leadership style of things, where I have to make sure that my people are happy, productive, clear and collaborative.
And how many people report to you?
About 5, I believe, at this stage, and it's going to expand to 6 very soon.
Okay, and these employees who actually report to you, are they AI engineers like yourself?
Some of them are. So I've got one of them that's actually coming out of university very soon, the same University of Malta. He started with us as an intern and he's been performing really well, so we'll be very happy to have him on full time. And otherwise, I'm also coordinating with the technical departments, because they are under my jurisdiction, given that I have a bit more of an evolved leadership style. We didn't designate leadership roles to them, and instead, because some of them are contractors, some of them are full-time workers, I'm coordinating between all of these different technical junctions to make sure that everything is coming together as a cohesive unit.
So, Natiala, just to understand now, Axon Park, how many employees are there in the whole organization?
About 20, I believe, more or so in that range.
Okay, and are you based in Malta?
Yes, we are.
Where are you in Malta?
We have our head office registered in Zabuc, but we are a remote first company. So realistically, we don't really work in the usual office style that everyone else typically adopts here. But instead we all work from the comfort of our own home, or maybe we go to coffee shops here and there. Sometimes we meet other colleagues, and then once a month we all meet together, have a nice lunch or do a team activity. In fact, just last week, I think we had a little bit of a sip and paint together for Halloween. So we try to keep the company spirit up in that sense.
And what is the average age of all these employees?
We average around late 20s, early 30s, to be honest. So we're all very young. We don't really have more than one or two individuals in their 40s.
Okay. And you are all locally based, you said. So do you have any foreigners?
Yes, we have quite a few. We've got part of it is a contractor company, and that's all based in Italy. But we consider them our colleagues because we've got very close partnership and we fly them over for company events and such. But we've also got some people from South Africa, Serbia, Germany, Indonesia. So we're very, very global.
And how do you handle the different cultures? I mean, Indonesia is totally different from Europe. So how would you handle that?
To be honest, it's not very difficult, because first of all, everyone's got a very good level of English, which facilitates everything. But for example, our Indonesian colleague, he's just life of the party, really. It's hard to not love them.
But in terms of timing, you know, Malta is waking up and they're going to sleep. So how does that work in terms of communication?
So what we usually do, so for example, we have some contractors who are in India. Part of my day in the morning is completely dedicated to them, making sure that their tasks are lined up, making sure that they can wake up the next morning and get cracking. And then we've got weekly alignment meetings. And we're also very frequently chatting asynchronously. And I think that with remote work, asynchronous is the way you have to do things, really, to keep your head afloat in any case.
Okay. Let's talk a little bit now about actually Axon Park. How would you explain Axon Park's mission to someone unfamiliar with immersive education?
So Axon Park has a very simple goal. At the company, we just want to revolutionize learning in a more modern digital platform, effectively, using techniques like game-based learning, where we gamify the learning process for students, AI for adaptive learning for students with different learning abilities. and making the process more, you know, more innovative, more fun, and more future ready, changing the paradigm.
So what makes Axon Park's approach to digital learning different from the traditional online education?
In quite a few ways. I think one of the biggest things that we've really cracked in on is the gamification aspect. So whether your typical online learning platforms would be like Moodle or these types of platforms that control, you know, what content is going to the students, what's reaching them, coordinating your Zoom meetings. We take a bit of a different approach in that we have our own sort of scheme of lessons, which are AI generated, but then approved by human educators. And these lessons are then packed into playable games. So as soon as a student hops onto our platform, they're not learning in the way of someone is telling them what they're learning and then they're going to study for an exam for it. We take a different approach. We want to make it fun. So the information is using AI automatically streamed into these games that we're creating that are proprietary. And our students then get to play and learn. And then, you know, what your high score is a reflection of your learning in a sense, right? So if you have a competitive nature as a student, you know, hopefully you're enjoying playing these games. And then as soon as you finish one, you're like, oh, I only got 80%. No, I want 100% next time. And initial tests have already shown that some students get really competitive when they start to play these games. So
how does critical thinking come into it?
Critical thinking, I think, is the most important part of it, because at this stage, we walk away from the paradigm where students are regurgitating what they've been taught and playing Maltese, you know how we say, a la pappagal. And we're going into retention. We're doing a lot of focus on the neuroscience behind learning, what causes retention. It could be as simple as having a student be prompted in a week to play the mini game again. We have some mini games where a student has to, for example, teach an AI robot a concept, and then they're evaluated on the quality of their teaching. That's going to improve their critical thinking skills, because now they're not just taking in, you know, the item for what it is. If you tell me, let's pick a random subject, let's say gravity in physics, I can tell you gravity is 10 meters squared per second or something, I've forgotten now. That's fine, that's a value. But then how do you really reason about gravity? If I had to teach it to you, I could use the Newton's apple example, for example. Things that are under the force of gravity usually fall down at a certain force, right? And this is the kind of way that we want to shape the students going forward. So if you're explaining it, you know, there's the protege effect, and now you know for a fact that you don't just understand it at the very superficial level, but you really have a tangible kind of understanding of the concepts you're having to learn nowadays.
It's like learning through play. Is this the concept that you're trying to portray?
That is exactly what we're going for.
Okay. Can you give an example of a project that demonstrates your AI in action?
We were in the past 2 years at PlayCon Malta. So we had the platform set up on a couple of laptops and the students got to play, and we curated the lesson for year sevens, which was marine biology. So we had all of these terms of phytoplankton, zooplankton, apex predators, food chains, food web. I learned a lot as I went on as well, because I'd forgotten all of my year seven material by then. And we had the students play them. And some of our mini games were games, for example, a simple quiz, you know, quiz you on the stuff. Cool, okay, most people did not struggle with that. But then we took a bit of a different turn and we had more custom mini games, one of which we called Quiz Katana, which was like, you know, this Fruit Ninja-like game? Mm-hmm. Not exactly on that level, but basically you've got to slash a correct answer. So you've got to be quick, you've got to be reactive. First we had a segment where they learn the content. There is being explained to them via text-to-speech that, you know, oh, phytoplankton is the lowest primary consumer of the ocean, etc. And then they're playing their games. The content was all split by the AI in sections. So we've asked it to generate a lesson about marine biology life in Malta. We found as well some different materials, some different PDFs and some textbooks that we were able to get royalty free from different sources. And we were able to assemble that together. And after the fact, the students were then playing these mini games, and a lot of them were able to go, for example, okay, you have that little timer going tick, 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 tick. And it's going, okay, what's the primary consumer? And you see some of them slashing phytoplankton like it's nothing.
Okay. Year seven refers to how old?
About 11 years old, I think. It would be our form one.
No, just to understand sort of at which age we're talking about. So it is at secondary level.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And how does Axon Park ensure that its virtual worlds are both engaging and effective for students?
We've learned a lot throughout the years, right? So we started first by doing bespoke lessons for universities. That was sort of our main focus. So everything was very tailored before we went into this direction of creating these AI-generated lessons. And university likes everything to be very corporate, very professional, very up to a certain standard. But when we tested the schema with students, they just repeatedly told us again and again, this is boring, this is flat, this is lifeless. So one of the things we've made as a way to fix this issue was that we added a lot of colour. So lots of bright, vibrant colours. This was a marine environment, so we decorated it with different fish, different disco effects, lighting, animations, just making sure that the world really felt alive. You know, everything moves, a bit of music, having different effects even, that things are changing a bit dynamically as you go along. For example, we had a little animation of a whale shark floating above you just to really bring in the effect. And so immersion really became key here to keep the younger students engaged. Because if you're showing them a university level surgery room, they're going to look at it and be like, oh, this is boring. But if you suddenly show them something with lots of plant life, lots of fish moving around, animating around you.
So your focus has been very much on movement, on colour, and on making it interesting and exciting. So in order for them then to engage with the material that you've presented.
Exactly.
Is this what the aim is behind?
Yes, exactly.
And then how do you then assess whether they've really absorbed the content?
So part of it is through actually playing the games. Back then, we were talking about play constant because we've advanced quite a bit. But there were about four different mini games. So that taught you the content differently. Some on Apex Predators, some on Phytoplankton, for example. And you would know who actually learnt and who didn't in person, to be honest, because they were screaming at the answers. Some of them either had their friends with them going, no, this is phytoplankton, this is phytoplankton. And some of them had their parents with them as well, trying to correct them. So you could tell that they were actually reading and engaging with the material just by how they played the games and how they answered. So if they were really quick or just clicking here and there, you know that they were just shooting off. But if they stood to read the question and then looked around and carefully, you know, examined their environments, you could tell that they were absorbing the content much better.
So they weren't really looking up to understand what a phytoplankton is?
No, because it was taught to them within the same lesson.
And these are the type of fish that you were making reference to?
Yes, the primary consumer, if I remember. See, I learned something as well.
Okay. And have you moved on from this? I mean, I noticed that this is part of biology. Are there any other subjects that are part of a different project that you may have looked into?
Yes. So that was just one demo lesson we made at PlayCon, just to have, you know, that first demo that students could play.
I know you mentioned PlayCon, but I think you need to explain it for the sake of our listeners as well.
PlayCon was an event held in Ta'ali around middle of October, and it was a gathering of different aspects of the video game industry in Malta, involving lots of things like esports, independent studios who are creating their own Maltese-based games, or different companies that are quite involved in the gaming scene, as in the video gaming scene.
Okay. So you were going to talk about maybe another project. I mean, you mentioned biology. Was there another project on different materials that you may have looked into?
Yes, so we've expanded the material quite a bit since then. We've made the system very adaptive, so it's able to handle any subject that a year 7 student could potentially go for it. Our target audience is between 8 and 14-ish, so we've been looking at all of the different syllabi, the curriculums, the subject present at every curriculum level, and we created we tailor the AI in such a way that it's able to generate lessons for all these different vast things. So it's not just marine life and biology anymore. Now we support physics, maths, computing, chemistry, biology, anything really effectively. But we wanted to sort of hone down into these main subject domains to actually be, you know, curriculum aligned as soon as we start to roll out and launch.
So it seems the focus has been very much on STEM subjects, which is the science, technology, engineering, and math. Can you see this working in the humanities or in the commercial subjects?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the most effective ways we've seen the platform work for us internally has been language learning. I spun up a lesson on German, for example. My German is very rudimentary, but I was at least able to answer some of the quiz and felt a bit accomplished in being able to get my articles correct. It even supports languages like Japanese, which is very interesting to see how AI can really broaden the horizons of what is doable via language learning.
So what do you do with all this material that you've created in the form of games? Do you sell this data? What happens?
So we're taking a bit of a two-step approach. Some of them, we have a base, let's say a base content library that comes for free, because part of our mission is making education more accessible as well to students across the globe. But then we're looking into the idea of creating custom courses of more, I wouldn't say necessarily interesting, but maybe less tangible subject material. For example, one of the best ideas that we've had come up is, for example, just one course about the whys in life, right? Why is the sky blue? Why do plants photosynthesize? Why do this? Why do that? And that's quite an interesting thing for people who are more interested in their own learning journey compared to what's usually followed by the traditional path. So our base content library will be free to play for all the students signing up, but then we will have quite a few lessons and courses that are paid for and that you would eventually, you know, spend your money to buy in case you want to expand your learning library. But as I said, we want to keep education accessible as well, because that's part of the beauty of technology, right? That you can help others who are maybe less fortunate in or have less opportunities.
Have lecturers in some way given or been part of this creativity?
Yes, they have. So we collaborate very closely with the University of Malta, actually, especially with the Faculty of ICT. I'm back in touch with some of my old lecturers even, because they're quite strong supporters of the platform. And we also have quite a few communications happening with the Ministry of Education, with teachers in different schools, with some important and prolific people in the education department. So we're really trying to bring this into the Maltese scene in a very tangible manner.
Okay. We will now take a short musical break. Please stay tuned to Campus 103.7 to continue listening to the discussion on shaping the future of education, the Axon Park story. Before we go, the following song,
My Bestie by Mama Kay,
was selected. Natalia, why did you choose it?
I love this song for two reasons. One of which is because it's Japanese lo-fi, which is something I love listening to at work, and I love the Japanese culture. The second reason being that the artist Mama Kay is actually a 59-year-old woman who first started to pursue her dreams of being a pop star. And this is a song she wrote for her daughter to express her love towards her family.
Naite ta koto wo zuibun otanari.
Welcome back to Business Frontiers in Malta with me, Anne-Marie Tech. Now let us get into the second part of the discussion. With me I have Natalia Malia, Lead AI Engineer of Axon Park, and we're discussing Shaping the Future of Education, the Axon Park story. Natalia, the AI Act was launched a year ago. Can you elaborate further on the AI Act and its implications today?
Yes, thank you, Anne. So the EU AI Act is this new policy that the European Union is trying to establish in order to help us have more ethical AI. So I briefly touched upon ethical AI in that it helps to reduce bias and a couple of other features. But mainly it's a set of regulations to help companies stay complicit and to make sure AI doesn't violate our fundamental human rights. So which fundamental human rights would this be tackling? For example, constant monitoring, social crediting. These are the types of subject that without regulation, AI can take over with. And suddenly you have AI deciding what career you go on, what grades you're getting. And since AI is not this perfect tool, you end up in a situation where one wrong move from the AI and you've been misclassified as someone who maybe has a lot of potential to become the next Gordon Ramsay. And instead, you're being placed as a pilot. You know, it's completely different from your strengths because AI has these problems effectively. So the EU is trying to put a schema where people are always, we call this human in the loop. So no matter where AI is touching, there's always at least a person verifying this. There's a tangible way to try to catch the AI's errors. And people who are not compliant face a 35 million euro fine in case they are found to be non-complicit. Some of these effects roll off into, for example, you always have to highlight that an AI system is talking to you if you are touching a chatbot. There has to be transparency in where AI is done. And there is the classification of systems, so which systems are high risk. For example, an AI that affects your education can potentially be considered very high risk, because it affects your learning outcomes. And you obviously cannot play with that. It's unethical. It's going to affect your human rights. So there are these different classifications. We start at no risk, low risk, medium risk, high risk. And there are these tiers that companies have to check to make sure that they are compliant with. And if they do fall into one of these categories, the EU AI Act asks this very simple question: what are you doing about it? When it's not stopping you from using AI, it's telling you, how are you going to make sure that it stays complicit?
Okay, so you mentioned the different levels of risk. Can you give an example of low risk?
Low risk would be your day-to-day chatbot. You go on, for example, a website to buy a t-shirt, for example. You ask your chatbot, how many size M t-shirts do you have? And it tells you, okay, we have 60 size M t-shirts in stock. That's very low risk. It's not affecting you. It's not affecting your human rights. It's very benign.
Okay, so let's go to the other side. Now, what is high risk? I know you mentioned education, but is there another example you can give?
For example, hiring, which is one very, very big one, making sure that you are not hired based on some AI's decision, but on actual human feedback at the end of the day is a big one. We go into things like emotion recognition, which could end up being very unethical in case it misclassifies your emotion and it does something about it in any social situation. What if, for example, you have the sun in your eyes, you're squinting, and that's misinterpreted as an angry emotion because you're squinting, right? But the sun's in your eyes. It's not because you're actually angry. And suddenly that has implications, right? On the workplace, for example, you are corrected on bad behavior for it. In school, maybe you're sent out of class for being perceived as aggressive by the AI.
What is the means of redress for some mistake that could actually happen?
So this all goes back into the human in the loop idea. So every time an AI says something, before it's made official or before it's made public or before it's made final, there's always at least one person at the helm who is checking what the AI is saying. In case of, for example, let's pretend we have human recognition right now. I'm looking at your face, you are smiling. Okay, let's take it to the human. The human verifies, looks at you and goes, yes, you are definitely smiling in this moment. Lovely. We proceed.
Okay, but there are mistakes that can happen, and you may have HR managers who have tagged certain criteria for recruitment. AI uses these tags, and the HR manager may have left an important tag out. Then what?
then it's up to the HR manager to check again, because the AI can give you an output, but at the end of the day, AI is never going to be able to be held responsible for mistakes. It's always going to be the human. So the human has to always double check what their AI is telling them. If you've forgotten a tag, check what the AI has given you. If you're hiring, for example, and the AI has given you your CVs, check what are the commonalities between the people you have been hired. Are they from a particular demographic, a particular race, a particular orientation, a particular gender, with a particular religion? Check to make sure that there is no commonalities in between the portfolios you're getting as the strongest. There will be some demographics which are more represented. So, for example, if we are in Malta, it's quite likely that you will have more Maltese candidates applying, for example. But if you have no foreigners at all, or no people with different origin at all, then you probably have a problem on your hands.
Okay. Earlier, you were discussing and you were mentioning a few technical words. And one word you mentioned was social crediting. Can you explain what that means?
Social crediting is where there have been some pilots worldwide, especially in China, for example, where either good behavior or bad behavior will give you, we call social score, right? So you give up your train for a lady on a pregnant woman, for example, you give up your seat on the train, that's going to give you positive social points because that is a good gesture. You swear at someone on the streets, that is a negative gesture. So you lose social points. But these become a problem because then they influence different parts of your life. Social scoring can be what influences, are you able to take out a loan at the bank? Are you able to continue to tertiary education?
Okay, so I can see then these would affect the implications of this. I see. Okay, very, very interesting, but very worrying. How does one then address these mistakes, you can call them?
So the good news is that by the EU AI Act, things like social scoring and emotional recognition are in the unacceptable tier, which is a tier I had not mentioned previously. So these are subcategories that are a complete violation of human rights and are not under any circumstances allowed on the market. This is how we are combating these systems, because unfortunately, if you allow it to exist, it will exist. And in the US, we started to see a few of these trials, and same in China and other parts of non-EU areas. So I'm very glad that the European Union has taken these measures to try to control these things.
Okay, let's now talk about AI and XR technology. We've talked a lot about AI. So what's XR technology?
XR just stands for mixed reality. It's the blanket term for applications such as virtual reality, where you have those big goggles you put on your head and suddenly you're on a roller coaster. Very fun. And then you have augmented reality, which is, I don't know if you remember the very hit game that came out a while ago, Pokemon Go.
Yes.
That used AR because there was the camera function. You would have your background right in front of you, and this cute little Pokemon would appear overlaid on top of the background, and it made it seem like this Pokemon was in the real world. So that's why it's augmented reality. It's an augmentation of the world that you exist in. Another popular application are these augmented reality glasses, where you have glasses on top of your face, and then you have things like, we call it an HUD, which just means heads-up display. The same way you have a dashboard on a car, you would have this kind of HUD on top of your glasses, giving you, for example, Google Maps, where's your next destination? And it's overlaid on top of the real world, which is your current reality.
So this is enhancing a 3D virtual learning experience?
It does, yes. So our platform is, it was originally crafted to be VR compatible, and we are working to integrate that with the current AI generated frameworks. The good thing is that virtual reality by nature is incredibly immersive. By just putting the goggles on, you're already transported into the 3D environment. So given that in these 3D environments, we are very careful, for example, about spatial awareness, right? Does it feel as vast as the real world does? Because if everything feels really cramped or off scale, then there are issues called, for example, uncanny valley, where you start to feel like it's close enough to the real world that it's familiar, but still far away enough that you're like, wait, something is wrong. This is a very popular phenomena, for example, with video games that have graphics that are really realistic, but almost not realistic enough to be convincingly human.
So I take it because you're so experienced in this field, you can really detect which is human and which is virtual reality.
I don't think it's just me, to be honest. I think that as soon as you become exposed to these things, you do have a sense of it. So Uncanny Valley, for example, is a phenomenon that you can experience. Have you ever seen a true mirror?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's Uncanny Valley.
I see. Okay. All right. So what are the biggest challenges in integrating AI with this immersive XR learning?
One of the biggest challenges for sure is maintaining consistency, I would say, because AI is, we call it non-deterministic, which means that every time you run the AI for something, you will never get the same answer twice. That's the beauty of it, because it means that it's very unique each time. And for learning, especially, you get to face a variety of contexts and content. But when you're going into the technical, programmatical side of it, we developers, we love something that is rigid, that is stable, that is reliable, that you can count on. That's our bread and butter. So these two concepts are diametrically opposed, as a matter of fact. So a huge challenge is making sure that the AI is unique enough to fill your business needs while being stable and consistent enough that it doesn't break your program by some unexpected output, or it doesn't give you content that is, for example, malicious. We can't have the AI swear in front of children. We can't have the AI encourage children to do negative things. It's just for learning. So it has to be very much guardrailed in several facets.
And how do you measure the effectiveness of the AI-driven learning experiences?
Luckily for us, we don't have to do it because other people have done it for us in several studies.
I see.
There have been a lot of publications on the effectiveness of game-based learning. AI takes it to the next level because AI is non-deterministic, as I had previously mentioned. So you will always have fresh content. But previous studies have shown that game-based learning for students can improve their learning and retention capabilities by as easily as 40%.
Have you tried this out?
Yes, we have.
Locally?
Locally, yes. In these events, especially in the PlayCon that we've been through, we definitely saw students walking out going, "Daddy, Daddy, I learned what phytoplankton is." You know, it's very sweet, but also very validating in the kind of product that we're trying to develop.
And has there been any discussions now at a higher level in Malta? When I say higher level, we're talking here on the policies that they're being discussed at the moment.
So far, I haven't personally seen that much in terms of policies, but in terms of our work, we are in fact working very closely with the Ministry of Education to try to push this platform to go out on a national level, because apart from obviously that is going to help students a lot, the fact that we collaborate so closely with teachers, with lecturers, with Ministry of Education, with university, that's given us a lot of important insight on what game-based learning and these immersive virtual environments really require to both satisfy the needs of the entities that are trying to teach and to also keep it on this innovative level.
So are there any ethical considerations that you must account for when designing AI for students?
Oh, absolutely. We've got the Kids GDPR as our main one. So GDPR stands for General Data Protection Regulation. It is incredibly important that we protect the data privacy of our students, of these children especially, because these are the most vulnerable users that we will be promoting our product to. One of the most important things is, for example, data retention. We cannot, without parental consent, keep the data of these students. Apart from the fines, I mean, the fines are always going to be part of these regulations. That concerns me less, to be honest, than the idea that these students could have their private data exposed. If it comes into pictures, what happens with these pictures? These are a very vulnerable group of people. There are some very unsavory individuals on the internet that could exploit such things. So from an ethical perspective, and as well, obviously, from a business perspective, we have to make sure that at all costs, we protect their privacy, we protect their data. Everything comes with consent. Everything has to be consent approved. We have to be careful that we only store only the most important data, because even email can be really, really something we watch out for, because that could be traced back to any individual. So we have to have a lot of considerations on this aspect.
So the platform, Axon Park, you know, seems to emphasize equal opportunity. How does AI help make learning accessible to everyone?
The beautiful thing about AI is that it's quite rolled out and quite global at this stage. I think everyone and their mother uses ChatGPT nowadays. So that's become a really widespread technology. And it's much more low cost than trying to establish a school, trying to establish a university. Part of what we're trying to do is that it runs so effectively on a lot of technology. So even if you have a laptop from 2 years ago, it should still run. Even if you have a government-provided laptop, it should still run and run reasonably well. And by doing that, you know, no matter what your socioeconomic background, you are able to just go on and learn. And AI is obviously very low cost in certain applications, so it doesn't have to stand in the way. Your means don't define how much you can learn, at least at a very basic level.
And how would you design the AI systems to accommodate diverse learning styles and backgrounds?
What we are looking into now is AI personalization. So a subject that is very near and dear to me, for example, is the topic of ADHD. They have very, very different needs when it comes to learning, very different attention spans. Virtual reality has shown through some couple of papers that it has really helped students be more engaged and more present in the moment. Game-based learning has shown that even students with ADHD are able to perform, get their scores and retain without having to listen to a teacher talk, for example, because some students are not able to focus as much as others. Some students maybe have some more difficulty in the human interactive element of it. And AI also has the benefit of a very simple thing. It can explain things in very, very simple manners. All you need to do is tell it, for example, listen, I like football. I need to learn about physics. So teach me physics through football. That is something that we are going for. So this really caters to the individual's interests, which is going to try to immerse them a lot more in their language rather than...
It's all very interesting, but don't we lose this personal connection with, you know, the teacher and the student? That seems to be missing. How do you account for this?
The thing is that it can actually help the connection between the student and their teacher, or their lecturer anyway. So the educator in question is going to be the person that would tell them to, you know, maybe during the lecture, go on Axon Park for 10 minutes and play these games, right? It's not taking away from any of the lecturing time or any of the human interaction. And this is something about AI in general that I do like to emphasize, that if you use AI as your co-pilot, you take away a lot of the administrative, a lot of the mundane, repetitive tasks that you do have to do in your day-to-day responsibilities, right? So we offer something like lesson generation. When you create a lesson plans, I've heard it a million times. My mother's a teacher, my friends are teachers. They all tell me lesson planning takes so long. If we try to minimize that part of the equation, then what do you have left to do as an educator apart from the millions of other tasks? One of the biggest things you have time freed up for now is spending more time with your students face to face. Being able to dedicate that energy properly. You know, you're not trying to check off exam marks or correcting now because you have an assistant. Instead, you're able to really, you know, crack on with their needs. You know, little Johnny, what do you need from me as an educator?
Right. Okay. So what role then does AI play in promoting, you know, inclusion within your virtual learning environment?
Right now, the way that we're trying to design it is not that AI tries to promote inclusion, but that the AI is inclusive by default. So it doesn't assume anything out of you. Everyone starts out as a tabula rasa, and the AI sort of builds its understanding of you from that. So no matter where you come from, you stand on the same level as everyone else from the get-go.
Before, you were talking about protecting children or vulnerable groups. How do you ensure that they are safe in your digital world?
Right now, as we are going to launch, it is going to be a single player journey. So there will be no interaction between different students and there is no risk of exposure. Going forward, we are going to include a multiplayer scheme, and we've already had some very in-depth discussions about what multiplayer looks like. One of them would be age bracket worlds. So 10-year-olds play with 10-year-olds, 18-year-olds play with 18-year-olds. But we definitely don't want a situation where 18-year-olds and 10-year-olds are in the same room. That can be catastrophic. Going into it a little bit as well, the curation of the worlds themselves, we are very mindful of everything that goes into our 3D environments. Our director of 3D and our 3D world builders are making sure that all of these worlds are curated to the targeted age demographic, more colors, more animations, etc., but also careful of the verbiage, the signs that go into the 3D worlds, and the appropriateness of the characters as well. Some of them are more cute and cartoony in these younger audiences, which should hopefully act as a deterrent as well to a more mature audience that might prefer something a bit more realistic or a bit more personable, perhaps.
Natalia, can you explain your partnership with Trust Elevate and how AI supports online safety?
Trust Elevate is a platform that helps you verify parental responsibility, right? So this means that one of the most important things about children's consent is that children do not consent, in fact, and it's always their parent or guardian that provides the consent for them. Trust Elevate is a measure of compliance that allows you to be sure that you are getting the correct age estimation, because we've all been there when we were younger. You always click the I am over 18 box. But how do you validate that? You validate that through the platform, and you have the parent that has to provide some form of proof of identity such that you are sure that this is an over 18 individual and most likely that this individual is in fact related to your child that is giving you any form of consent that has to do with the child in question. That helps protect the child, because then you are really sure that you are getting the proof you need, that this is their parent slash guardian, and also making sure that they have different options such as parental controls, for example. In this way, the parent can be notified about the child and their behavior online. They can monitor what their child is doing. In the case of education, we are then able to give them an overview as well on the performance of their child. But Trust Elevate is taking care of the compliance side of it.
There seem to be a lot of assumptions here. Assumptions that people have access to technology. Assumptions that they understand what this technology is all about. There are also assumptions that the child might actually tell their parents, yes, yes, this is okay, please approve. How are we taking care of this?
That's a very good question, because that is very pressing in our day-to-day. Launching in Malta has its benefits, right? That all of the students under Maltese jurisdiction, let's say about Form 4 upwards, I believe, they all do have their own personal laptop or tablet. So this way, we are quite sure that they do have the technology that's available. And we have run some tests as well on a school device. It does run the platform, so we are aware that we are able to provide this. Secondly, we do have, as you correctly mentioned, educating them about the technology. Because we are partnering with schools and with these teachers, the children can, in fact, be shown how to use the tool. And there are very little ways, given that they do have a child account, that they could tamper with it in such a way. To handle the parents' understanding, though, that's, I think, why we show up to a lot of these panels, these conferences, etc. We want the name Axon Park to be associated with trust, with compliance, with safety. We want to be in a situation where a parent hears the name Axon Park compared to all of the new platforms they're hearing, like Roblox, Fortnite. We want to give that level of assurance that this is a platform where your child is going on to learn, to be safe, to be protected, and it's for their education. It's to something productive in their life.
Okay, let's move on now to students and the future. What advice would you give students interested in AI or XR technology careers?
Go for it. the sky's the limit when you get into this field. And right now, there are so many opportunities for you. And we need you right now more than ever. Because what's the point of creating all of these EU regulations when there is so little talent to enforce it? Especially not just AI engineers in general, but women in AI, women in STEM. We are completely underrepresented. And quite frankly, I'm tired of being a unicorn, please.
What does that mean when you say a unicorn?
Basically a rarity. Okay. There are really not many women in AI on the island. There are very, very, very few. It's getting better, but we are still in Europe. We are only 22% of the workforce. And in Malta, the number might be a little bit better, but still local talent is ways away from being where we need it to be. And we need as industry as well to create these opportunities for people fresh out of university. So they can work, they can gain the experience, and they can really contribute to the future of AI in the local scene.
So then how can young people get direct experience in AI and immersive learning while still in school or university?
As a tinkerer, one of the best bits of advice I can say is just learn by doing. Get on your AI platforms, play around, mess with them, go on these different tools, try to break it. Because if you break it, you know what it takes to, you can understand what makes them up more. And in general, you know, if you're going for AI, one of the most important things is learn how to code. Learn, familiarize yourself with the programming languages being used. One of the main ones is Python for anyone who is interested. That is the number one. Do some projects, you know, tinker, play, be the mad scientist you see in all of these sci-fis, right? That is the only way you're going to learn how to do these things.
So you're talking about people who are in the field. But for example, I am a user as opposed to, you know, actually wanting to code. So how would you advise students from the different other faculties apart from the ICT?
One of the biggest things right now is AI literacy. So apart from, I would still give you the same advice. Go for it, use it, break it. You know, get your hands dirty with the product because that's the only way you're really going to understand what AI can and can't do. And that goes into AI literacy, which is the ability to understand what AI is, what AI can do, but also what AI can't do. And even though we are trying to, the EU AI Act is trying to also promote AI literacy as a mandatory for different companies who are going into the AI thing, I think this applies to us in general. We have to now live with this tool, so it benefits all of us to just learn what it does. Try to find the bias for yourself. Ask AI to generate for you an image of a doctor, see what it gives you. It's going to give you a white man. 99% of the time, until you kind of remind it, hey, you know, women are doctors, people from different races, different religions are doctors, you know. There's a big world out there that AI doesn't understand yet. And having the right perspective on that is going to show you what the gaps are and what still needs to be done there. And that goes hand in hand with the social revolution needed as well. Historically, we don't have that much data about women being doctors, for example. How do we cater our media towards that? Are we going to show more Grey's Anatomy with more female doctors, for example? Are we going to show more female coders to try to bring it up to a 50-50 and teach our AI that, in fact, women code, women are in these STEM fields, women do this? Not just women, people from all kinds of backgrounds. We need to create an equilibrium of all the different facets where people are grossly misrepresented.
Natalia, thank you very much. So this is all the time we have for today's program. I wish to thank our guest, Natalia Malia from Axon Park, for taking time out to accept our invitation. I would also like to thank Mark for the technical assistance of the program. Thank you so much for tuning in to Business Frontiers in Malta. I am Anne-Marie Teig from the University of Malta, and it's been a pleasure spending this time with you.